From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, inside the trial of Ratko Mladic, the butcher of Bosnia. The breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s led to some of the worst bouts of violence on the European continent since World War II, including ethnic cleansing and genocide. In areas where different ethnic groups had lived side by side for decades, Muslim men and boys were systematically marched out of their villages and slaughtered by the Serbian army.
My family, she says. Why didn't they kill me, she is asking. Why didn't they kill me?
This campaign of ethnic cleansing lasted from 1992 to 1995. It was only stopped when NATO airstrikes led to the end of the Bosnian War.
NATO planes destroyed the Bosnian Serb communications network. They couldn't even make telephone calls. President Milosevic had to do something.
After the fighting, some of the perpetrators were brought to justice in The Hague.
The first witness that's testifying is an extraordinary young man who was 14 at the time, Elvedin Pasic, and it's a crime that occurred in 1992. And it mirrors the crime committed in Srebrenica in 1995.
That's a scene from the new Frontline documentary, The Trial of Ratko Mladic. Mladic was a general in the Serbian army. He was charged with genocide and crimes against humanity.
The prosecution must prove his intent to destroy in whole or in part the non-Serb population in Bosnia. The defense insists he's innocent and never participated in or ordered any crimes.
The documentary took 6 years to make and featured unprecedented access to not only the prosecutors and witnesses to the genocide, but also to the defendant's lawyers and his family. The trial of Ratko Mladic tries to answer some of the fundamental questions about genocide, why it happens, how human beings can commit such atrocities, and what constitutes justice for victims, survivors, and their families. I'm joined now by the film's co-director and producer, Rob Miller.
It's my pleasure.
Who was Ratko Mladic? And he becomes known long before he's taken to trial in The Hague as the Butcher of Bosnia, which is quite a moniker.
That's correct. So Ratko Mladic was the head of the Bosnian Serb army. So after the kind of explosion into conflict, a Bosnian Serb republic was formed within Bosnia. So it was a Serb part of Bosnia.
And this is the Republika Srpska?
That's the Republika Srpska. And they inherited a lot of the kind of munitions and equipment and military know-how from the former Yugoslav army, which was known as the JNA. And at the head of this very powerful war machine was Ratko Mladic. And yes, he's now become associated with the moniker the Butcher of Bosnia because he has become synonymous with several crimes, the worst crimes in Europe since World War II. And one of those was the shelling of Sarajevo, and the other was the murder of over 7,000 men and boys in Srebrenica in 1995.
And not just any men and boys, Muslim men and boys particularly.
They were Muslim men and boys, yes. I mean, there are two genocide counts against in Mladic's indictment, and he's accused of the murder of over 7,000 Muslim men and boys in Srebrenica in 1995. And within the film that we've made, you can see archive consisting of news reports which were broadcast around the world, and you see the Bosnian Serb army overrunning what was the kind of UN safe haven, separating men of a fighting age and women and children. The women and children were put on buses, and then the prosecution alleged and the court decided that Mladic was guilty over a five-day period of detaining, executing and murdering and then burying the bodies of all these innocent men and boys.
It's particularly striking watching this very modern footage of separation and the run-up to genocide. But Mladic himself was actually in hiding for over a decade and was finally captured. How was he caught?
That's an interesting question. So he was indicted in 1995, just after the Srebrenica genocide. And he went into hiding, although he was kind of hiding in plain sight. He was protected by kind of various powerful groups, particularly by the Serbian government. And so the Serbian government weren't prepared to hand him over to the international authorities. And then gradually his support waned over a period of years and he went into hiding proper and became very sick. And I think the turning point came when Serbia wanted to join the EU. And one of the conditions for joining the European Union was that they handed Mladic over. And that's how he ended up in The Hague.
What did you know about Tito, Yugoslavia, Serbia, Mladic, all of this before you began working on this film?
So I was 15 when the conflict in Bosnia started. And I think 15 years old is when you start becoming aware of the outside world. And the conflict in Bosnia was a conflict which was very visible on our television screens in colour in the heart of Europe. And I certainly remember seeing those images of frightened refugees and seeing those horrific images of men behind barbed wire. I come from a Jewish background, and so, you know, I was aware of the Holocaust, and I think a lot of those images evoke the Holocaust for me and certainly had an impact. I was also vaguely aware of someone called, you know, Mladic, who was a kind of powerful and instrumental figure within this conflict. But after university, I actually went to work for a human rights organisation, which specialised in trying to raise awareness of genocide and genocide prevention. So I became even more familiar with what happened in Bosnia during the 90s and Mladic as a consequence. And I left human rights in order to make films precisely like this one. I was always interested in issues of accountability and justice. So when we finally managed to get access to the tribunal, it really felt that we were making a really important and not just historic, but globally kind of relevant film.
You have access to the UN International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, ICTY. What made you decide to follow this trial specifically?
So I was actually working at the BBC at the time that Mladic was arrested in 2011, and an executive producer who was a kind of senior manager on the day that Mladic was arrested approached me, and I think he knew about my background working for a human rights organisation and suggested trying to get access to the trial. And I was slightly kind of sceptical about whether or not a United Nations court was going to be prepared to kind of throw open their doors and allow cameras in, particularly in such a significant and important trial. And after about a year of negotiation with the tribunal, they have finally allowed us to start filming. And we were very fortunate that the lead prosecutors in the case were open and were very proud of what they were doing. And it was only when we started filming the opening statements that we met with the defence. I'd sent them various emails. Branko Lukic, who was the lead defence lawyer, I'd sent him various emails, which he hadn't responded to. And I managed to kind of corner him in the tribunal and then make an arrangement to go and have a meeting with him. And I said to him, I made the proposition, we'd like to make this film. We feel that if we're going to make a film about a trial, it's incumbent upon us to tell both sides, both narratives. And that's what we intended to do in this case. And thankfully, you know, he also saw the value in that.
I think it's one of the things that was particularly striking to me about this film, which is that a film which is about genocide and crimes against humanity, that you really do get into the minds of both the prosecutors and the defendants. And the attorneys for the defendant seem quite clearly not simply appointed, but truly on the side of their client.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that was very fortunate from a filmmaking perspective. There were three kind of lead counsel, two of which were Bosnian Serb, one of which came from Chicago, but had a kind of Serbian background. And I think they believed wholeheartedly in the innocence of their clients, and they were very passionate about trying to disprove the case of the prosecution. I don't think it was just a job for them. It was something that was very important to them and very important to the Bosnian Serb population at large.
And the very first witness is a young man who was a boy at the beginning of this conflict, and his story is heartbreaking. Tell us a little bit more about that witness.
The gentleman that you're referring to is a gentleman called Elvin Basic, who in 1992 was kind of enjoying a very pleasant childhood in his village in, I believe it was, it's Kotovarosh. And then suddenly one day, his village is attacked. War breaks out and his childhood is destroyed forever. And the prosecution started their case with Elverdin because they felt that it really encapsulated Mladic's crimes.
And his village is a Muslim village.
His village is a Muslim village. He comes from a Muslim background, but he talks about, or he did talk in some of his testimony about playing with children from different ethnic groups. His village is attacked by the Serb army and his neighbours, which is kind of feels very significant that one day you think you have quite cordial relations with your neighbours and the next that they're attacking you. And he flees his village and it's an incredible kind of odyssey of running away from one attack after the other. And then eventually he's caught with his uncle and his father by Serb soldiers and they instruct them to lie down on the ground and start the process of separation, and he doesn't want to leave them, and his father is encouraging him to get up and to leave with the other women and children. And as he relates, he says that his uncle says, "Get up, you will survive." And he was 14 at the time. When you listen to his testimony, it's as if he's regressing back to being 14 again. His testimony, his story, it's very present, and I think that really demonstrates the kind of trauma that so many of these survivors suffer from, that they're still living with the effects of the war. He still hasn't found his father's remains. He knows that his father and his uncle are murdered in a school. He's still looking for their remains. He hasn't found them, but he feels that he survived and he has a responsibility to keep on talking about what happened to him and his family and what happened to his people in that part of Bosnia. And that's what he does at the court in the Mladic trial, and that's what he does in our film.
He describes that he dreamed of his father the night before testifying, and then he finally sees his face again. It's very hard to watch.
It is hard, but I think it demonstrates the catharsis of testifying, and I think different witnesses react in different ways. And I think for Elverdin, I think you can see that there is a kind of unburdening that happens every time he tells a story. And I think that is reflected in the fact that that night, during a kind of a break in his testimony, he can finally see his father's face. So extraordinary bravery, and also good to know that actually this process that he and so many other victims contribute to is actually doing him personally some good.
There's a woman, too, who becomes a sort of central witness in the film, whose first son is killed by a mortar and whose second son and husband are murdered. And it's quite brutal because there's a film you have of the father calling out for the son to leave the woods. What's the story behind that part?
So the woman you're referring to is a lady called Saliha Osmanovic, and she's a mother from Srebrenica. And she's one of the mothers that when the Serb army come into Potocari, which is the UN base where lots of the people were in Srebrenica, the Muslim population fled to for protection to the UN, and she was put on a bus and bussed out of Srebrenica against her will. And as you've kind of explained, she had two young boys. One was killed by a Serb mortar. Her husband and her son fled through the woods when the Serb army came in. Saliha went to Potocari to this UN base, but the men, not trusting what would happen to them if they were captured by the Serbs, fled through the woods and around Srebrenica and tried to get to safety, to Bosniak Muslim-held territory. And her husband, Ramo, is captured. And the Serb army make him call to his son and other Muslims in the woods and calling them to try and encourage them to surrender. And they tell Ramo to tell them that if they surrender, no harm will come to them. And tragically, that wasn't the case. Both Ramo and his son, Erman, and the other Muslim men that they were with ended up being executed and were later found in mass graves. And Saliha, another extraordinarily brave woman, comes to give evidence about her experiences, sits in the courtroom and faces Mladic and tells her truth, which was a remarkable thing to be able to witness.
You actually go with the prosecution to a mass grave at Priador, and yeah, that becomes a focal point of this over 500-day trial. Why does the prosecution go to the grave itself?
So there are two genocide charges, though, against Mladic, one of which is the 1995 genocide in Srebrenica. But there's a second genocide count, which is for crimes that took place in Prijedor, which is a municipality in northwest Bosnia, and five other municipalities around Prijedor as early as 1992. And in all the history of the tribunal and all the cases, this genocide count had never been proven. And Mladic's was the last trial in which it could be proven. And that's hugely significant for the victims who are desperate for what they experienced to be acknowledged in the proper legal way. And there's an equally strong feeling on the side of the Serbs who are desperate for it not to be characterized as genocide. So during the course of the trial, this huge mass grave is unearthed in Prijedor on the site of the Tomašica iron mine. And when the grave is discovered, it's deemed significant enough for the lead prosecutor in the case, Dermot Groom, to go out and investigate, to go to this site, which turns out to be enormous, and look at the forensic evidence of the bodies that are being uncovered. They were buried very, very deep down, which means they're very well preserved to the point that you can actually see facial features. And that's significant within the case because it's easier for the pathologist to determine the cause of death. And in most cases with this grave, the cause of death was considered to be violent and followed a kind of pattern of execution.
Violent as in high velocity bullets.
That's right. And it's an incredibly important discovery. It's important for the case, but it's also incredibly important for the family members of these people that just went missing one day in 1992, that they were taken away from their homes and were never seen again. And what you find is that that is the case. Still in Bosnia, there are people that are missing. There are loved ones who are still looking for them. So the discovery was very significant for this particular genocide charge because the size of the grave suggested a very kind of organized, systematic approach to burying the bodies. And one of the characteristics of genocide is that it is premeditated, that it is organized and systematic. So the prosecution saw this as a very kind of substantial break, but it was also hugely significant for relatives of loved ones who went missing, who hoped that their loved one, their father, their son, their brother would be found in that grave.
There's a young woman who goes to identify her own father at Prijedor and her uncle. It's another very emotional moment in a film filled with emotional moments. But you film her in her home and then you go with her as she actually looks at the clothing and the body as it's pulled out. And she must have been quite young when her father was taken away.
Yes, I mean, I think she was about 14 as well. And there's a scene in the film when she recounts that day in 1992 where the soldiers come to her house and her father tells her not to worry because she hasn't done anything wrong. And then she doesn't see him again. When graves are found, there are survivors who go to the graves and kind of contact the authorities to see whether or not their loved ones are in the grave. And there are various survivor groups which those survivors belong to. So in order to get access, I had an incredibly wonderful, talented and sensitive producer who is Serbian, actually, and who spoke the language and contacted these groups and spoke to a number of people who subsequently found Elvira and spent many hours talking to her. And like Elvedin, I think she wanted to tell her story. She wanted people to know and understand what happened in Prijedor, what happened to so many members of her family and what happened to her father and her childhood that was very brutally snatched away from her. And she was very brave, very courageous, and we were very fortunate that she allowed us in order to follow her on this really kind of horrific journey, although you do hope that it provided some sense of closure. And we've watched that particular scene many times, but it's one that still affects me, and I think still affects all of us, because there's a moment she sees her father's broken bones, and that's obviously incredibly disturbing. But there's a moment when the person in the morgue lays down her father's clothes, and you see that kind of moment of recognition that that is her dad. And you think about how many times that, you know, she's hugged him and put her head against that particular shirt. And yeah, it's just totally heartbreaking.
And then it's juxtaposed against moments where actually you get to sit down with the wife of Mladic and his son, and they're convivial and they're hanging out. What is it like to film that kind of scene?
So, yes, I mean, I think what became very apparent very early on in the film is this kind of split perspective on Mladic. For kind of the Bosniaks and Croats, he's the ultimate villain, and for the Serbs, he's the ultimate hero. And I think it was very important for us in terms of the balance in the film to explore that side and to try and talk to people that were closest to him and knew him best. You know, when we got access to the defence, there was a fair amount of distrust, particularly coming from the UK, where we were identified with NATO and the Western approach to the Balkans and the particular narrative that we're all familiar with here in the West. And that was replicated with the family, particularly with Mladic's son, who initially was very distrustful. We spent a lot of time with the defence, and they came to realise that we were very sincere when we said we wanted to make a balanced film. And similarly, the family were very sceptical at the outset, but the more time we spent with them, they realised that we really wanted to kind of deliver on what we had proposed, which was to kind of tell both sides. And they were very friendly and very welcoming and very anxious to tell their side and to talk about the individual Mladic, who they knew as a father and as a husband, as opposed to the kind of burly and rather brutal figure that we're familiar with. That's actually kind of, that's being seen, regarded by some victims groups as quite a controversial step. We thought that it was actually just quite a conventional approach, and because you were making a trial, you would naturally follow both sides of the conflict. But some people have had a difficulty. There's also the humanising of Mladic. I think that's also been difficult for some victims groups. But we deliberately humanise him because I think he is a human being. I mean, I'm hugely respectful of anyone that wants to criticise what we've done in the film, because I didn't live through this conflict. They live through the conflicts. They've lost, they've suffered. So at the very least, they have a right to express their criticism. I hope they'll appreciate the film for other reasons, if, you know, there are certain things that they take particular issue with. But I think that if you want to learn something from this experience, learn something from this conflict, and learn something about this man, you have to accept his humanity. I think it's very convenient for us to say, this is a monster, this person isn't human.
I'm curious how working on this over the course of several years and being embedded in this court made you think about the European experiment. Right now, you know, from Brexit to the rise of populist right-wing parties that are extremely anti-European across the continent, it suggests that there's a forgetting that the risk of armed conflict in the heart of Europe is not that far away.
I think you're absolutely right. We made this film over 6 years, and I think in the course of making the film over those 6 years, the world's really changed. And what became clear is, you know, particularly with the kind of rise of the far right in places like Poland and Hungary, particularly with politics of division, which is evident not just in Europe, but in the US as well, that's been revived by kind of opportunistic politicians. And the film was always meant to be a warning of what this type of ethno-nationalism, the very dark places that it can lead. But I don't think Henry, my co-director, and I realised quite how urgent that lesson had become. And it's a very sobering lesson to think that this type of politics, where you identify particular groups as the other, that particularly dangerous type of politics is on the rise. And hopefully that's one of the things that comes out when people watch the film, that this is not something which is historic. This is something which is very relevant to today's world. I'm not saying that necessarily in all cases that brand of politics leads to mass graves, but it certainly has, and in fairly recent memory, right at the heart of Europe.
There's a moment that's particularly striking where one of the prosecutors shows the Muslim populations of villages in the early 90s and then within 2 years of the conflict, and they are emptied of Muslims. There's no one left. And it's a very, very striking moment. It's almost strangely as hard to see as the unearthing of the ground itself.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of documentation, there's lots of graph. And I think that also if you see it in the context of a film where you've explored a kind of human story, I think you have all these kind of elements that come together and you appreciate the tragedy of one person. And then you see the enormity of the crime and how that tragedy is shared by so many. I think you're right. I think it's an extraordinary piece of evidence and utterly devastating in terms of what happened to these Muslim communities in Bosnia. And if you think about it, the whole process of a trial is an incredibly traumatic and divisive one. And to think that the warring factions are going to turn around and universally accept the judgment and just embrace each other at the end of one of these very traumatic processes, I think is kind of very unrealistic. And that's not to say that the tribunal won't contribute to peace and reconciliation in Bosnia. It just might take a few generations. There are other criticisms about the length of sentences that have been given out to certain accused, where they've served their sentences and then gone back to the communities where they perpetrated the crimes. I think there are legitimate criticisms. There are certain imperfections. I think we have to remember that international criminal law is still in a very early embryonic stage. But in terms of the values that the tribunal represents and put into place, I prefer to live in a world with those values, where powerful people who do terrible things to powerless people, they're properly held account. I'd prefer to live in that type of world than a world in which justice is completely absent. So I hope people watch the film and realise that international criminal justice is not just something which is important, but it's something that's absolutely vital to the world that we live in and goes right to the heart of, you know, who we want to be as a species.
You know, you mentioned at the beginning about knowing your own history. And one of the new leaders of the prosecution, towards the very end, a lawyer is brought in to kind of close the trial out as leading the prosecution. And he describes himself as the son of Holocaust survivors. How much do you think that the Holocaust itself was a presence in this trial?
When you're talking about Alan Teager, who became, when Dermot Groom actually left, then he was replaced by Alan Teager, who became the lead prosecutor on the Mladic trial. And he talks in the film about a sense of recognizing the feelings and the experiences of Muslim victims and how he can identify. And there's almost a sense of fraternity that he feels. And his parents were both Polish and they were in a number of camps and experienced terrible horrors. And it's certainly a kind of motivating factor for him. And when I interviewed him about it, he talked at the very beginning of the tribunal how some of the Nuremberg lawyers came over and kind of made inspirational speeches. So it can be viewed as one story. You know, it started with Nuremberg. It moved on to the tribunal. And I just hope there's another chapter and there will be another institution which continues this incredibly important story.
Rob, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Rob Miller. He was co-director and producer of the Frontline documentary, The Trial of Radko Mladic, which aired this past March on PBS. The film is currently available online. Mladic was convicted of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, and was sentenced to life in prison. First Person is produced by Dan Efron and edited by Rob Sachs, with production assistance by Benjamin Soloway. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I'm your host.